From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You have La Carreta, and right across the street from it, on the same street, is a place called El Calentano. And this is just classic Santana Mexican food in a taco truck. Everyone should love it, you think, right? Well, everyone except the Santa Ana City Council.
That's our very own Gustavo Arellano talking about the two loncheras that set up shop on the corner of Central and Bristol in Santa Ana, California. I just have to tell you that after being, you know, involved and watching the decriminalization of trucks in L.A., to even hear a whisper that Santa Ana is considering banning taco trucks is just astounding to me.
And not only that, this is not San Marino we're talking about. This is Big Bad Santana, the largest city in the United States with an all-Latino city council, a city that's basically Mexican, over 80% Latino, super majority of that. Like, you have Mexicans from everywhere. And Santana has always had a problem with loncheras. So what's happening now, it's not an outright ban, but they basically want to legislate them out of experience. They want to pass all these regulations, for instance, that taco trucks can no longer be within 500 feet of an elementary school, that all taco trucks have to have access to restrooms. It just makes it so draconian that none of these loncheras would be able to exist. Oh, and then they could only park for, what is it, like an hour before moving again? It's absolutely preposterous. So that's why now more than ever, you should be supporting loncheras. And guess what, folks? In L.A., they decriminalized loncheras. Carne asada is not a crime. I didn't make up that line, but everyone knows it in L.A.
Is this a thing of, like, trying to forget your roots?
Absolutely it is. I mean, you have the city council, just all of them wanting to get, in their words, more respectable businesses in Santana. And anything that goes from a taco truck apparently is not respectable enough. But then you also have these NIMBYers. And it's not just white folks, mind you. I always say, who hates Mexicans more than Donald Trump? Mexicans do. So you also have a lot of Mexicans who say, oh, yeah, you know, they call them roach coaches. They say none of them are paying taxes, which is a lie. They're saying that none of them are inspected by the health department, which is an absolute lie. I'm sure in L.A. is the same as in Orange County, where all taco trucks have to park at commissaries every night and get inspected by, you know, they have to pass these inspections again and again and again.
Okay, so to remind us of why we love them so much, tell us about the food at these two trucks that park across the street from one another.
Okay, so La Carreta is going to be your more classic overall lonchera. So that's where you're going to have food from a lot of places of central Mexico. So you have the humongous huitlacoche quesadillas, or even better, the ones at Flor de Calabaza. They're nice and fluffy with, you know, with handmade corn tortillas. You also have picaditas, which I call them like a gargantuan sope with crema on top of it. Those come from Cuernavaca. You have your choriqueso. So it's going to be, I mean, choriqueso is basically going to be chorizo with melted cheese, almost like a queso fundido, but inside of a taco. But what I love most about La Carreta, they sell barley water for their agua fresca.
That's hilarious.
Oh, it's hilarious and it's delicious. Agua de cebada. So, you know, if you've never even thought of it before, it's almost like a sweeter horchata, if you could believe that. So it's milky, it's creamy, has like this nutty flavor to it. And they sell a big, huge, almost like a canteen of it for about $3. So what I like to do, like, I'll get my snacks there at La Carreta, get, you know, a couple of food, and then get the big old barley water. But then I cross the street to El Calentano, because for me, El Calentano is more interesting than La Carreta.
Why? What do they have there?
El Calentano in Mexican Spanish means someone from La Tierra Caliente. So La Tierra Caliente, it's the region in Mexico that spans the southern part of Michoacán and the northern part of Guerrero. So this is El Calentano is one of the few places in Orange County, if not Southern California, to specialize in this cuisine. The most famous dish from that area is the green pozole. They don't sell it there, unfortunately, but they sell almost all the other good things. So they have the enchiladas, Michoacán style, so it's folded over like a quesadilla. They have the biggest quesadilla I've ever seen in a restaurant, which is, and the tortilla, the corn tortilla that goes with it, it's literally as thick as Rolling Stone used to be back in the 1980s. So thick and just, you know, because now it's a little bit thin. But what I love most about El Calentano is their mole.
So it sounds to me like a calentano is like plates of food, not snacks.
Oh, yeah. And so that's one of the interesting things about el calentano. So most places just snacks. No, here you have a whole meal. So for instance, the mole, they give it to you in a big, huge plate. It's going to be $8 around there. So it's a little bit more expensive than tacos, but it's a humongous portion. They'll give you like basically a curtain of cecina, which is salted beef. And the mole is unlike any mole I've ever had in Orange County. So it's a bitter mole. It's not like a mole negro. There's no sweetness to it. It's nice and bitter, and it starts picking up on the heat. And then they'll serve it over cecina. They'll serve it over chicken, but it's absolutely delicious. And on top of that, they have like 7 different salsas in their little salsa cart right there, from the light green avocado type to the one made from oil, a salsa de aceite that burns even more. And it's absolutely amazing. I just don't understand why anyone would be ashamed of food like this in their city.
Okay, I'm curious. Why do they want to have the regulation about taco trucks being close to schools? It seems like it would be much better than like an ice cream truck or...
Well, because they say that taco trucks are not healthy food. And both of these places, by the way, if you want to go the vegetarian route, they sell tacos de nopales. So they grill up the nopales, the cactus paddles. They chop them up into, you know, little slices, little slices right there. They put them in the tortilla. Absolutely vegan taco. Gluten-free, healthy food. No, all it is demonization. You'd think at this point, Santana of all cities would know better, but they don't. Follow the lead of Los Angeles, decriminalize these loncheras. And frankly, that's one of the main reasons why a lot of people go to Santana that aren't from there, to go to these taco trucks.
Well, you know.
That's why you go.
That's why I come. And now I have new places to go.
Yeah. And God bless you for that.
So is this a fait accompli? Are organizations that represent the loncheras negotiating with the city?
The great thing is that this has happened in the past. In 2006, the Santa Ana City Council actually passed a law even more onerous than this one, and the loncheros got together, sued them, and sued them successfully. So once again, these loncheros are getting together. And you want to talk about, you know, success stories with these loncheros. They went to the city council and they said, you know, these taco trucks have allowed us to put our kids into private schools. It's allowed us to have a home. We're not trying to fight with you folks. We'd like to work with you. If people say there's problems with us, let us work it out internally. And so right now they're in negotiations or talks with the city. But rest be assured, if the city gives them something that the loncheros will not like, they'll go sue. I frankly think there should be a taco truck strike. They should get all the loncheras one day and just travel around City Hall, circle them, and just start honking their horns. There would be so many crowds asking for these trucks. Like, the city council needs to be shamed with the deliciousness of a great, perfect taco.
Perfect ending. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is editor of the OC Weekly and host of KCRW's Orange County Line. Find a link to his coverage of the city council proposal to ban taco trucks in Santa Ana. I can't even wrap my mind around that. On our website, go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
During the 20th century, it embodied Vietnamese history. It was used for protest poems. It was used for espionage during the Vietnam War, when there was like this Viet Cong cell in a Saigon pho restaurant. And they operated and moved weapons around for the Tet Offensive.
That's Andrea Nguyen talking about pho, the Vietnamese bowls of noodle soup that are now so popular that they're part of the Oxford and Merriam-Webster dictionaries. Nguyen's written a book dedicated to the food called The Folk Cookbook. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
You must feel like you're the pho ambassador.
You know, I'll take it because it's a great way for people to learn about Vietnamese food and culture.
First of all, tell us how to pronounce it.
Well, if you want to impress a Vietnamese speaker, you would say pho.
Pho.
Yeah, sort of like languidly, sort of romantic, you know. I have this thing in the book in the opening where I say that pho is the mistress that you steal away to see, whereas rice is like the dutiful wife that you can rely upon.
Because traditionally, did people mostly eat it at home, or was it always something that you went out to eat?
You would go out to eat pho because it's something that, you know, you got to simmer for a long time. You got to have a stove. A lot of people don't have stoves. And so you would have to, have a lot of coal fire that you would continue keep going for a while.
In a very hot climate.
In a very hot, humid climate.
Is it a really, really old dish, or is it something that's fairly new?
A lot of people think it's old, but, you know, it dates back to around the turn of the 20th century. So we're talking the early 1900s, late 1800s. And that was when we were still under French colonialism. And the French left a lot of scraps. And the pretty scrappy, resourceful Vietnamese and Chinese cooks put it to good use to make noodle soup broth.
Was it related in any way to Chinese noodle soups?
You know, I think that it's related to a Yunnan noodle soup that has wide rice noodles, a very hot, clear broth, and a lot of protein and vegetables on top. If you can imagine, you know, northern Vietnam around Hanoi at the turn of the century, 20th century, there's a lot of commerce going on the Red River. And, you know, people who were from Yunnan were working on these trade boats owned by French and Chinese traders. And so, you know, they would be like traversing the Red River all the way down to the Gulf of Tonkin, and they needed something to eat. And so when pho came about, I can just imagine that the vendors, you know, put all of these ideas together that flowed from China into Vietnam under the circumstances of the French colonials there who were slaughtering cows. And so that's how we had these parts. And so when you taste pho, you go, God, what is it? How do I make sense of it? And that is totally Vietnamese. It's beguiling. It's kind of mysterious, but it's also very delicious.
You talk in the book about how the first time you were confronted with a side of all different kinds of herbs and condiments that you put in the soup, you were a bit befuddled because you didn't grow up with it that way.
Right. I grew up with kind of strict northern-born Vietnamese parents. And even though they had like lived in Saigon in the south of the country for decades, they were still very much wedded to this kind of purist aspect of eating pho, which meant you got the bowl, you got your noodles, you got your toppings, and there were no, like, bean sprouts, no Thai basil. Forget the sriracha, which my mom said, that's a Thai thing. We don't eat that. We got chilies and maybe a few sprigs of mint that we plucked from the yard. So when I went to USC as a college student and also when we went out to eat pho in Little Saigon, we get, like, these plates of produce, and I didn't know what to do with it. Because we never were allowed to eat that stuff when we were at home. So there are different styles of eating pho, and that's what people need to understand.
For so long, the country was defined by these wars. Did pho change in response to that?
Totally. So there are certain markers in Vietnamese history during the 20th century. So one of them was 1954, when the country was split into two. So people could decide, you want to stay in the north, you want to stay in the south, you want to cross back and forth. So they had a year to move back and forth. And when they did that, a lot of the northerners brought their pho tradition to the south. The south already knew pho. So we're talking Hanoi versus Saigon. And in Saigon, pho morphed into like these big bodacious bowls with a lot of produce and herbs and such. And then, you know, it became a little sweeter, the broth did, than in the north. In the north, again, you know, Spartan, purist, more salty than sweet. In the south, big bowls, sweeter than salty. Then the next marker in history is 1975. A lot of people like my family fled from the south of Vietnam. And so we brought that southern tradition to wherever that we landed. And, you know, for us, it was Southern California. So a lot of what we have here in Southern California in terms of pho and actually all over the United States is more of a southern Vietnamese tradition of pho. Big bowls.
You talk about culinary pho and cultural pho.
Yeah. So there's like the culinary side of like, you know, how do you make it? You know, like the charring of the aromatics, the ginger and the onion or the shallot. And then, you know, all your ingredients and how do you compose a bowl? Then there's the cultural side, which is like, what does pho mean to Vietnamese people? The other thing I want to add is that pho is not just the noodle soup. It also is about those flat rice noodles. So that duality is also very Vietnamese because we're Vietnamese, but there's also Chinese and Western influences in there. It's this amalgam of cultures.
So talk to me a little bit about dry pho, or pho that, as you said, is not always broth-based.
Right. So we're just talking about the noodles. So, you know, if you go to a pho restaurant or a Vietnamese restaurant, you'll oftentimes see there's pho noodle soup. And then there are these other rice-based dishes, you know, stir-fried pho, pan-fried pho. And in Vietnam recently, I also had deep-fried pho. So you can imagine, like, pho going to an American state fair where it's dipped in batter and then deep-fried, and then there's, like, a stir-fry on top. There's all different kinds of pho. And so the dry pho is just the noodles being manipulated, and they're oftentimes the wide noodles like chow phun. Now, in Hanoi these days, you'll also find something that's like a chicken pho noodle salad with the broth on the side. And then you've got the rice noodles, which are more like a medium-width noodle with chicken and a few herbs. And then this kind of like spicy soy sauce, vinegary sauce on top. And you eat everything together and have a little broth in there, too. The young kids love it in Hanoi.
Sounds delicious.
So let's talk about making it. You know about my star anise situation.
Yes, your kryptonite.
It is my kryptonite. And in reading through the book, it seemed to me that it was beef broth, star anise. Chicken broth, no star anise.
Yes, for me, that's the way it goes, Evan. So you can be saved. I can. There's a pho for everybody. No one can be left out of the pho action.
When I walk into a pho shop and I smell the overwhelming smell of star anise, is that sort of shorthand that I should be aware that maybe the broth isn't what it should be?
Yes, because I don't think that pho broth should ever hit anybody on the head with the spice notes. It's a very nuanced dance of flavors and aromas. And so when I walk into a good pho shop, I ought to be smelling like, you know, the broth hitting the raw onion and the scallion, and also, like, you know, the kind of fragrant aromas. But it shouldn't be that star anise, because that's almost like a cheat. I'm wondering, you know, because you've been simmering that broth and then you add the spices in there, and nothing, no one ingredient should hit you over the head, because that for me is imbalance. That is the strange, you know, subtleties of Vietnamese food that makes it so appealing to people.
Earlier in our conversation, you talked about charring the aromatics. Talk to me a little bit more about that.
A long time ago, there was this theory that somehow pho is related to French pot-au-feu because they sound the same. Pho, pho, fire. And pho, cooking pho requires fire. So what the heck? And the French were there. But, you know, pho, the word actually refers to the Chinese term for rice noodles. So, you know, there is no direct correlation. Pho, the Vietnamese noodle soup, is not a descendant of French pot-au-feu. But I think that there is something to be said about that charring of the ginger and the shallot or the onion. Because, you know, Vietnamese people they're like smart cookies. And so they picked up a lot of ideas from whoever that happened to be in their land and controlling them. So I think they were trying to mimic oven roasting, you know, your bones and the onions and garlic and stuff that you would use to make like a brown stock. But we have no, you know, ovens in Vietnam, but we have braziers and we have a lot of charcoal. So still nowadays, when you go to Vietnam, you'll see pho cooks charring those aromatics on tiny little braziers. And the shallots in Vietnam are so small, the size of like little boiling onions. I do not want to be that kind of cook. I love the large shallots we have in America.
And so let's talk about the beef broth. What are the ideal selection of bones that we should be looking for?
Right. So a lot of people will say, oh, well, you got to use, you know, oxtail, or you got to use all marrow bones. And the thing is that for me, I like to mix bones because marrow bones tend to have a lot of fat. And right now, they're really expensive because of the whole brothing movement and also pet owners. So, you know, I'm like jockeying with people to select my bones at the butcher shop. I'm favoring blending bones. Some marrow bones for the fat, knuckle bones for tendon, and you've got that gelatinous quality, and then use some neck bones for meatiness. I am not one who's into all oxtail pho because I feel like the tendon in the oxtail kind of like just creates like this cashmere effect where everything's just too soft, and pho should be like this dance of flavors. And that's how the spice notes and the aromatic notes come through.
So we're going to be cooking a broth a long period of time. Can we use a pressure cooker?
We totally can use a pressure cooker. We can cheat. I mean, you know, the thing is that, and I cheat because there are times when I just want a bowl of pho very quickly, and I will doctor up cans of Swanson's broth, okay? I'm just going to be straight up, and, you know, it makes two servings for my husband and me, very quick, and easy and it's delicious. And then I also use a pressure cooker. And for a long time, I was skeptical of the pressure cooker because, you know, when I first started out with it, I threw everything in there and I did all the charring of the aromatics. I put all my stuff in there. I cooked it up. And it was like, it's, you know, it's like the Beavis and Butthead of appliances where it's like really, really like intense cooking and it's extracting all those flavors. And what I got in the end were like parched white bones, like, you know, they were like out in Joshua Tree or something like that. But the flavors were so melted together that I felt like I just lost it. But over time, I was just like, I needed something that could enable cooks to make pho on a weeknight. So there are pressure cooker recipes in the book that take an hour and a half from beginning to end. And I nearly went all pressure cooker until my husband, who's not Vietnamese, said, you can't abandon stockpot pho because that's where you came from.
And sometimes that's what you want.
Right.
Sometimes you want to have that pot on the stove that you're constantly checking in with. So we've been talking about meat. We've been talking about chicken. But you have some workarounds for non-meat eaters.
Correct. A lot of people, when the book was in process, they said to me, vegetarian pho is not pho. And I was like, we have Buddhists in the country. Hello? And in Southern California, at certain Buddhist restaurants, you will encounter vegetarian pho. Oftentimes, it's just like one version. But in my book, I have like a chicken version and a beef version because they're two distinctive broths. And so, you know, they're all vegetable based and they're just delicious.
I bet they are. I'm very hungry.
I think we need to go get some pho.
I think we should get some pho. Andrea Nguyen's authoritative guide to Vietnam's favorite soup is the Pho Cookbook. Next, we turn our attention from Mexican and Vietnamese food to cherry pie.
They got a cherry pie there that'll kill you.
That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Wait a minute. You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
Dark Undercurrents, cherry pie, and a damn fine cup of coffee. Yes, it is the Twin Peaks of David Lynch's imagination. The original show aired on ABC in the 90s, and now Showtime has released new episodes of the cult classic. Superfans have even visited the town that Twin Peaks is based on, and they've eaten the show's most iconic dishes, like food writer Leslie Bala. So, Leslie, what's the name of the town that Twin Peaks is based on?
North Bend, Washington. It's actually the Snoqualmie Valley. So North Bend is the town that has the mountain behind it, the actual Twin Peaks that you see, and Tweed's Diner, which is the diner. That's the double R stand-in. And when you see the sign, every shot they show of the sign, the mountain, which is Mount Si, is in the background, towering over everything along the whole valley. And Snoqualmie is the other main town of the little towns of this valley. That's where the Great Northern is, or as we know it, it's the Salish Lodge. It's the massive, beautiful old hotel on a cliff overlooking waterfalls that you see in almost every sort of shot when they get to that area. Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely place.
So the Double R Diner, what's the cherry pie and the coffee like there?
So it's called Tweed's. It's Tweed's Cafe, Tweed's, T-W-E-D-E-S, apostrophe S. The coffee isn't great. To me, it tastes like a standard cup of coffee, and they give you little plastic creamers on the side and regular sugar. And like for Seattle area, you'd think that everywhere has amazing coffee. It's not as damn fine as the mugs because everybody's hawking everything Twin Peaks up there. And it's saying damn fine cup of coffee and a piece of cherry pie, Tweed's Cafe, home of. The pie, it's a little gloopy inside. They make no bones about that it's canned cherry pie filling. Their crust is like shortbread. And I saw something, an interview. You know, everybody's talking about Twin Peaks up there. Everybody's talking to everybody. So I saw an interview with the owner of Tweed's who said, you know, most pie crusts are only a couple of ingredients. Well, mine have seven. And I was like, well, as much you can taste that.
Has anybody suggested to them that they serve David Lynch's coffee? Because doesn't David Lynch have his own roast?
He does. And I was trying to look for David Lynch coffee. And I wonder why they don't, or why David Lynch. I mean, he eats, when they filmed in town, he ate in town. They ate at the diner. They ate at the Quickie Freeze or whatever, the like dairy freeze across the street. He would get soft serve because it's just the swirled old-fashioned classic little old diner stand that's been there since the 50s or something. Yeah, I don't know why they don't serve it. It would be ingenious. But the funny thing about the cherry pie at Tweed's is right next door is a bakery, and that bakery makes cherry pie. And I was told there was a rumor that those cherry pies, which are quite good, were stand-ins for the pies in the show when they filmed the actual pie. Georgia's Bakery, they're making special chevron topped pies just for Twin Peaks. And they sell a lot of different pies, apple and stuff, but they also have donuts, which you know is the other big thing in Twin Peaks. Every time you go to the sheriff's station, they're eating, they have plates and plates of donuts. And on the show, they show boxes that say it's from the Double R as well, because the Double R is everything in Twin Peaks.
So aside from the soft serve place, did David Lynch have a favorite hang?
They filmed the exterior of the lodge a lot.
The Salish.
The Salish, yeah, the Salish Lodge. And they didn't film inside. I had breakfast. I stopped in for breakfast there one day. But what I'm pretty sure everybody probably ate at some point is this ginormous breakfast that they serve every day in this lodge, in their dining room. And you can eat it overlooking the falls. It's amazing. Can I tell you everything that's in it? It's pastries, steel cut oats, pancakes, fruit, a plate of eggs, three meats, a giant biscuit, some kind of honey presentation that they do with their own honey, coffee, juice, and I think there's even a dessert at the end. This giant, it's one thing, and it's like $40 of something like that. I'm sure every grip and gaffer, I'm sure everybody ate this thing because it's this huge beast of a meal. And that lodge is also like such a great place just to stop because of the falls and everything. But in their gift shop, they sell their own cherry pie filling. They have their own cherry pie there, and they have Dale Cooper, Agent Dale Cooper cocktails in their lounge. And you can get a damn fine cup of coffee there, just like you can on the show. Their coffee was better, I have to say. Sorry, Tweeds.
I think maybe after The Lord of the Rings, this idea of entertainment tourism has taken off in a crazy, crazy way.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And like I said, I think people did go there as sort of a cult thing, like let's go check out Tweed's Diner and get a piece of pie. But now with the reboot, and also, I mean, this is an old logging community that was dying in the 90s, and unemployment was high in the state, and especially in that area, pretty depressed. And then soon after, they really focus on recreation because it's a beautiful place for hiking and river rafting and fishing and lakes and kayaking. It's amazing out there. But also really embracing these things. You know, if Forks can do it for the Twilight series, I think that's also maybe when the Valley was like, wait a minute, we have this whole Twin Peaks thing. People are already coming. Let's all serve cherry pie.
So there's this overwhelming sense of like foreboding and darkness in the series. When you're up there in the Snoqualmie Valley, do you feel a sense of foreboding and darkness?
In the middle of December or January, when you haven't seen sunlight for, you know, a couple of months, it feels pretty depressing. Luckily, I get to come to LA. So I'm here and I get my sunshine. But boy, even just a couple of weeks stretch with no sunlight and it's gray and raining all the time and it's dark because it's winter, you get a few hours of sunlight, it feels like, or any light. It is dark and foreboding and you kind of feel a little creepy and sort of everybody kind of looks gray and miserable, sort of like Bob in the show. It's like you feel like that person can come out of the woodwork anywhere. But then when you hit summer, it's like the most seductive place on the planet. You go and it's green and lush and it smells like they try to make laundry detergent smell. It's so fresh and floral and beautiful and the sunlight's there longer than LA and it's just absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, It's this really dual personality, much like the show itself.
I've got four hungry lawmen out in a police cruiser. We need donuts and coffee, hot. Two black, two white, no sugars.
A dozen donuts, four cups of coffee, two black, two white, no sugar.
Join us for pie!
Find a link to the article Leslie Balla wrote for Hollywood Reporter. It's called A Hometown Foodie Tour of the Real Twin Peaks. It's on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Hi, Santa Monica.
Are you there, Santa Monica?
Hi, this is Evan.
Hi, this is Andrea.
And this is Kara.
Okay, so what is the difference between a nut and a seed?
We both just looked at each other and pointed at each other. And said, you tell it. Well, nuts and seeds, they're botanically related.
I'm talking to Andrea Tutungian and Kara Tannenbaum. We called them up in New York to talk about nuts. They've eaten a lot of them for the latest edition of their cookbook, In a Nutshell.
Many nuts are seeds because if you planted them, they could grow their own little plant.
Generally speaking, seeds are usually smaller than nuts, but not always.
So, you know, we do have some seeds in the book as well as nuts, poppy and sesame and little seeds. But there are, trying to think if there are any big seeds, Andrea.
Like the sunflower seeds are also
in the
book.
Seeds,
and pumpkin seeds are a little bit bigger, but that's pretty much.
Do we have any in the tiniest nuts or the pinoli
nuts?
I'm curious about the way that fat and texture of nuts allows vegans to do things with them that those of us who are not vegans don't think about doing.
Nuts are sort of remarkable in that way because they are naturally absorbent. So they're used as thickeners in many different sauces. We have some vegan recipes in the book, although it's not predominantly vegan. It is the fat and the starch and the combination of the fat and starch that allows that silky texture to be created.
That's so interesting that you could take...
I know, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that you can take a cashew and make cream out of it.
Well, think about a nut butter. I mean, if you think about it, a nut butter is pretty much strictly just
pureed
nuts. And if you think about a peanut butter or an almond butter, it's generally thick.
A cashew cream comes from, you know, that's not a far cry from a cream made of cashews.
So if we want to do these other things with nuts, do we need to have a really good blender?
It helps, yeah. The better the blender, the smoother the result. So, you know, we're Vitamix users, but it really does help.
Nuts tend to be really expensive compared to other protein delivery systems, which is kind of odd. Why is it so?
A lot of it has to do with labor.
Right. And, you know, they're hard to harvest, collect, cultivate, and
it's a longer process from start to finish.
So there is a lot of labor involved in sort of gathering some of the, you know, even the ones that are cultivated, like almonds, there's problems with cultivation and then with shelling and, you know, from beginning to end, they are labor intensive.
Seed to table.
They are labor intensive.
What are the best way for us to store them if we buy them shelled?
Oh, freezer.
Yes, absolutely in the freezer.
Yeah. Airtight in the freezer and you can really extend the shelf life.
And should we always have a variety of forms, so whole, shelled, and halved?
Right. It depends on what you're using it for. I mean, I tend to sort of use whole nuts. Whole nuts last longest. So when they're intact, you know, even out of the shell, they'll last longer than sliced or slivered or something like that. So
and not all nuts come in all variety of forms. Almonds, I would say, probably are the most have the most varieties out of all of the nuts.
So what are some of the ways that you use nuts? I don't want to say as a meat substitute, but, you know, that you use nuts in a way that is sort of center of the plate that it could be a meat substitute.
There's lots of things you can do. The most amazing thing to me is their ability to absorb and make sauces thick. So that's one of my favorite. You know, soups and sauces that are thickened with nuts are great. And then we do all sorts of vegetarian, you know, even classic 60s nut loaves kind of things, but sort of updated and tastier for the modern palate. There's a variety of those and, you know, nut burgers and and things like that. It's very easily incorporated, brings you lots of protein, lots of flavor, lots of texture.
Let's talk about a nut burger. Do you rely on a mixture of nuts, or do you lean on some that are more savory tasting than others?
You can really use almost anything. We often mix them with a legume or another grain.
Lentils.
Right. We have a lentil and cashew little slider, which is phenomenally tasty. And we make the classic black bean and pumpkin burgers in the recipe for those in the book as well.
Talk me through the sliders, not in detail. What do you use to hold the nuts together?
With the lentils, because they get soft when you cook them, the red lentils, we often throw in a little bit of breadcrumbs, but we've also been known to use quinoa instead of the breadcrumbs. They're savory and they have, you know, onions and peppers and that sort of thing. But my favorite binding ingredient is matzo meal. I'm a big believer in matzo meal because instead of using breadcrumbs or, you know, cracker crumbs or something like that, you can use very little of it and it absorbs a lot. Just enough to, you know, throw an egg in, throw some matzo meal in, pull the whole thing together.
And when you do that, when you use matzo meal, which tends to be, I mean, really hard, do you let it sit like you would with a dumpling? So
yes, right. It absorbs. Yeah. You know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes will do it.
So when I think of nuts in savory dishes, I think of them as being kind of hearty and maybe more robust. But pitch me some ideas that are a bit lighter.
A little sprinkle on salads if you're, you know, not wanting them to be the center, just like a handful or a small amount of sliced almonds on top of a salad or even within a yogurt.
Back to my favorite things, the soups. There's a classic white gazpacho that's made with Marcona almonds, things like that, which really don't, it's subtle. The nut is not screaming nut, it's just subtle.
I was just talking with Kara before we came in here how I could really go for some cold peanut noodles today, and it would be really a nice, cool, refreshing dish to have.
Then there's always like the coconut crust on the shrimp, you know, coconut crusted shrimp, things like that.
It's so funny. I forget that the coconut isn't actually a nut.
It is, yeah.
I rendered you
and we love it. We love
I
our coconut.
I rendered you speechless.
No. Love my coconuts, yeah.
Yeah, I think we all do. I wanted to ask you, why is a Marcona almond so different?
It's a different shape, first of all.
Right. It's less dry. So it probably has a larger fat content in the nut itself.
And are they always used roasted or are they sometimes utilized raw?
I've never seen them not roasted. We've only found them roasted. And I was recently in Barcelona and they were the only ones that I could find there were roasted as well.
So interesting.
And somewhere, you know, somebody has, I guess that's part of the processing that makes them commercially viable. But I don't know what one would taste like. We've tasted green almonds and I know you have them in California, but never a green Marcona almond.
I love green almonds.
Yeah, people love them.
They're so good. They're really addictive. I'm sure that nuts are like your children by this point after having lived with them for so long.
And,
ironically, we both have vegetarian kind of children, so not planned. But
so I would imagine that you don't think of any nut as being overrated, but is there a nut that you think is underutilized in a specific way and you would like to be an evangelist for a certain type of usage for that nut?
Brazil nuts. I love them.
Oh, yeah, Brazil nuts, for sure.
I know they're hard to
harvest.
They're hard to harvest. They're difficult to harvest. And they used to be the elusive ones that were in the mixed nuts when I was a kid. And there'd be a big bowl in somebody's house and there'd be those very odd-looking Brazil nuts that didn't look like any of the others, and I just love them. And they're not, they can be used for so many different, they are sort of high in fat, but you could probably use them instead of cashews or tons of other things. People don't tend to bake with them. But they can be utilized for almost anything. They're wonderful.
Pitch me a baking recipe with them, and the aroma must be incredible.
Delicious. Go for it.
A baking recipe with Brazil nuts. I would do probably a Brazil nut cookie, maybe with some ginger and some coconut.
That sounds. We like to double up on our nuts.
That's
a little nut crazy.
That sounds really good.
Is there something that you'd like to talk about that I haven't touched on yet?
Nuts.
Yeah, nuts. We're nuts. We're nuts. You know, a couple of years ago when the first version of the book came out, there was a lot of press about the wonderful health benefits of nuts. And it just coincided with the book being published. And we saw ourselves as lucky because it, you know, everybody sort of became into it. And I think that with the increase in popularity and people eating nuts, you know, there's a real place for this kind of cuisine.
And, you know, the health benefits coincide with the nuts have a lot of the good fat, not the bad fat. And people often stay away from nuts because they're high in fat, but they forget that that's the fat that's essential for the health benefits that Kara was mentioning.
Yeah, so a few months ago, I traded my Vitamix for a washer and dryer with a friend.
Sorry.
I see the future. That
there's a lot you can do in a food processor, too. The blender is helpful, but if you need to sort of, kind of would go with the washer dryer.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, really. Life is life, and nuts are nuts.
There you have it. Kara Tannenbaum and Andrea Tutungian are indeed nuts for nuts. So how does the smell of a freshly baked pecan pie, say, affect how it tastes? We explore that matter when the show continues. Don't turn that dial. I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Oysters taste better with sounds of the waves in the background. And yellow tomatoes don't taste as sweet as red ones. So says Bob Holmes. A PhD in evolutionary biology, he's been a correspondent for New Scientist magazine for over 20 years. His research about the senses, and specifically about taste and smell, culminates in his book Flavor, The Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. There is so much to unpack in this book. I'm so happy you wrote it. As one of our five senses, how important is taste to our flavor experience?
Well, probably not as important as most people think. Most of what you experience day to day is actually smell in terms of the flavor of food, as you can tell easily by just pinching your nose when you taste something. My favorite example is to take one of those fancy flavored jelly beans and pinch your nose and pop it in your mouth, and you can't identify the flavor. It's, you know, it tastes a little bit sweet and maybe a little bit of sour, but not until you release your nose and bring smell into the picture can you tell that, oh yeah, that's banana, or oh, that's mint. So most of what we think of as flavor comes from the sense of smell.
And why are there so few words in the English language to describe taste and flavor as opposed to descriptors that use our other senses?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer, but it's not just English. Most European languages have the same issue. Even the French don't have a whole lot of words for the flavor experience. All we can really do is to say that it tastes like something. Oh yeah, that tastes like lemon.
As a person who has had cats in the past, I'm aware that they, for example, have different ways of bringing smells into their heads. They do it through their nose, but they also do it through their mouths in a very particular way.
Right, that sort of curl of the upper lip. And that's something that humans don't do. When the cat does that, or a lot of other animals, they're actually drawing air into a separate organ called a Jacobson's organ up in the palate. And humans don't have one, apparently.
I was hoping that you were going to reveal a secret so that...
Alas, no. Although I do find that if I'm sniffing a glass of wine or something like that, I get a better sense of the flavor if I open my mouth slightly. And I'm not sure why.
But are there any different ways for us to smell that affect taste?
I kept asking people that question. Can I learn to sniff better and get a better appreciation of flavor? And no one had any very good answers. Actually, there was one. You know those nasal dilator strips that football players wear across the bridge of their nose to get more airflow in? That apparently improves your sense of smell. It makes it more sensitive, and you're better able to identify smells. and therefore flavors.
Maybe that will become a new accessory for wine tasters.
I've always threatened to wear one to a wine tasting. I've never actually worked up the courage to do it, but that's been on my list.
Are there other ways to help identify odors, maybe sorting them into categories as we do for taste?
Practice is the main thing. There are a lot of people out there that say, oh, I just don't have a very good palate. There's no way that I could pick out a whisper of peach in my white wine. That's just beyond me. But that's usually not true. There are a few people that have a very poor sense of smell. But what I always tell people is, if you can tell that two glasses of wine are different from one another, then you have the perceptual tools, and everything else is vocabulary.
And I understand that given a frame of reference from words, we experience it differently, even to the point of our brains lighting up differently.
The best study of that, I think, is with wine, again. Wine is this wonderful experimental medium because you've got all these different repeatable products. And so what people did was to give someone, put people in an MRI machine, a brain scanner, and give them two wines, one cheap one and one expensive one. What the subjects didn't know is that they were actually the same wine, the same $10 wine. And once they were told it was a $5 wine, and once they were told it was $90 wine. And they find that not only do people say they like the wine better if they think it's more expensive, but their brains actually show that they do like it better. Their pleasure centers light up more. So clearly, what we're expecting makes a huge difference to perception all the way down the line.
Which, of course, I'm sure flavor chemists and the huge business of food technology takes advantage of.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that stuff is really in the realm of, what goes on the outside of the package in terms of setting you up. But the flavor industry does all kinds of, fascinating things with designing flavors to make them more appealing, to make them more consistent as well. One of the big things that the flavor companies say is the reason that that jar of spaghetti sauce tastes the same every time you buy it, even though it's made with different tomatoes every time, is because of us. It's because of the flavoring that we put into it.
I wonder if you were to do a study of people based around that, where people were told that it was organic and seasonal and therefore variable versus technology influenced, what the reaction to the flavor would be?
Probably people would feel that it tastes better if they think it's organic. I ran across one study of, I think it was coffee, where, again, people were given two cups of coffee and told, well, this one's your normal coffee, this one's an organic one, which do you like better? People liked the organic one better, even though they were actually the same coffee. So expectation really does figure into an awful lot of things.
Yeah, it seems like flavor as a sort of catch-all of all of these different things, our sense of smell and our psychology, it's so human in a way because it's so variable and so dependent on whim.
Yeah, well, and it goes deeper than that too, because every one of us has a different set of genes. I mean, the studies suggest that you and I probably differ in about 30% of our odor receptors in ways that make a difference to perception. So when I taste something, it's different than what you taste.
Which brings into question the whole field of food criticism, but we won't go there. Let's talk about another element that also affects how we perceive flavor, the color of food.
Yeah, and again, that's probably an expectation thing. If you see a deep red strawberry, you probably expect it to taste a little sweeter than a pale pink berry with big white shoulders, just because that's what you expect. And in fact, studies have shown that a strawberry dessert served on a white plate tastes sweeter than the same dessert served on a black plate, probably because the white plate shows off the red color better.
Wow, so it's even down to the serving vessel.
Yeah, there's all kinds of studies like that. You think yogurt tastes richer if you eat it out of a heavier bowl or with a heavier spoon. There's just so much involved in our expectations of what's coming. And that's all learned, of course.
You related an experience that you had of being with some kind of tasting scientist. You can fill in the blank there a little better, where you rinsed your mouth out with a couple of different compounds and then had the experience of eating.
Yeah. The question was about whether, you know, this is something we touched on at the very beginning, about whether taste or smell is the more important sense. And you know, most of the information is coming through smell. So most people say, well, that's far more important. But this guy, who's a he was the director of one of the big smell and taste laboratories, said that he thought that actually taste, sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami, is more important because without that, you just won't eat. And it's easy to tell what it's like to eat without the sense of smell. You just pinch your nose or have a cold. But it's very difficult to cut out taste. But there are a few chemicals that will do it. There's a mouthwash called chlorhexidine that knocks out the taste of salt for a little while. And there's a tea made from some South American plant that knocks out sweet. So we decided to try the experiment of getting rid of both sweet and salty taste and then have a hamburger and see what it was like. And it was dreadful.
Was it like eating pebbles?
Yeah. Well, the texture was different than that. It was like eating styrofoam, I think.
How odd.
It was very strange, yep. And, you know, his point was the few people that do lose their sense of taste are usually cancer patients that undergo radiation for a head or neck cancer, and that knocks out, that kills the taste buds for a while, and they have a very difficult time eating because it doesn't taste like food.
After going through all of these studies that you researched for this book, do you approach the act of eating differently? Are you more aware of certain things that help you personally enhance your ability to enjoy flavor?
At least sometimes. Sometimes I just sit down and eat. If I want to get more out of it, I think probably the biggest take-home message is simply pay attention and try and articulate what it is that I like about this dish or about this wine or whatever. So I might try to pay attention to what's different about this apple versus the last one. So that's one. A meat scientist suggested to me, actually, that you're better off grilling a steak more slowly because it gives more time for the chemical reactions that add flavor as the surface of the steak browns. But those are little things. The main one, I think, is pay attention.
That's Bob Holmes. We've been talking about his new book, Flavor, The Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. We close out the show with a weekly restaurant recommendation from our favorite food critic. So stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now it's time for a restaurant review from LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. I understand we're going to Anaheim this week to Ma's Chinese Islamic restaurant. So what does Chinese Islamic food mean?
It could mean a lot of different things. I mean, it could mean the Xinjiang style, like mutton skewers that they have at places like Feng Mao here. It could be the sort of Uyghur cooking at places like Omar's and San Gabriel. It could just be Islamic versions of straight ahead Chinese cuisine, which is what you find at like the Islamic Chinese restaurant in Rosemead. Ma's sort of splits the difference between some of them. It's not explicitly Northern cuisine, but it isn't not. It's vaguely related to Tung Lei Shan, which was the first big Chinese Islamic restaurant in Los Angeles when it was in the San Gabriel Square. The chef there is Jamila Moss, who ran Chinese Islamic restaurants elsewhere in Orange County.
Okay, so let's start describing the food. Given that it's Islamic, we're not having any pork.
That is an understatement. So there's sesame bread stuffed with scallions, which takes 25 minutes to cook and can sometimes be dry, or a thinner, somewhat crisper and tastier version that you can get much quicker. That's the one I recommend. And so you can like stuff bits of Mongolian beef. Suddenly you realize what Mongolian beef is there, you know, beef stir-fried with scallions, which has a nice strong, meaty, salty, little bit of gaminess to it. I love some of the salt dishes. There's cold spiced beef. There's cold tripe with chili, which is nice. And I think maybe my favorite dish in the restaurant is these translucent slices of beef tendon that has been pressed into a kind of tureen that's really good tucked into the bread.
This is the kind of dish where we can talk about texture being like a prized component of a cuisine.
Right. Because it is slippery and it does have that triple al dente bite to it that turns slipperiness turning into a crunch.
I love that.
There's another beautiful texture food there too, which are sheets of, they're not quite pasta, but they're not quite not pasta, made out of ground mung beans. And they come in like little crumpled handkerchiefs with garlicky sesame paste.
Oh,
that's a really nice cold dish. As at Tang Lai Shan and a lot of the other Islamic Chinese places, they have a lot of warm pots, which are these gigantic tureens filled with broth, lamb, cellophane noodles, pickled cabbage that's almost veering towards the sauerkraut dimension, which is a good thing for the cold night that we're not going to be seeing for a while now.
So funny, it sounds like one of my auntie's like brisket recipe. So
somebody should do some scholarship connecting the two.
Yeah.
I bet that it could be done. There's also a dish that I hadn't seen before in this form called homestyle croutons in lamb stew, which is very close to the Xian style dish of braised lamb and torn bread that all the Shaanxi places in the San Gabriel Valley have. They have thick handmade noodles that they stir fry with, you know, vegetables, lamb, egg, what have you. And it's possible to eat a lot of sweet and sour things or kung pao things or things that are actually regular Chinese dishes that just happen to be halal, which you either might want or you might want to stay away from.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Ma's Chinese Islamic restaurant in Anaheim. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the whole show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. Let me have them tell you who they are.
Abby Fentress Swanson.
Laurel Garcia. Joseph
Stone. Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.